All right, welcome everybody. This week's Parsha is Parshas Emor. And the title of the class is George Washington and the Kohen Gadol. George Washington and the High Priest. Okay? So let us start with the video. Let us all go to the videotape. Let's go to the videotape here. Just a little share screen. There we go. This is oath of office. Oath of office.
Yeah.
This is great.
However dangerous to my reputation or disproportionate to my talents, it would have been inconsistent to have adopted a different maxim of conduct at this time. And yet, I feel a great difficulty as to how to act. I am Vice President, yes, and in this I am nothing. But I may be everything. General, you are here.
I am, Mr. Adams.
Yes, we are ready to administer the oath of office.
Your service.
General, if you would please place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand. Repeat after me. I, George Washington, do solemnly swear.
I, George Washington, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Faithfully execute the office of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States. So help me, God.
It is done.
God bless George Washington, President of the United States.
Fine.
All right. There we have it. Okay.
That's a good show.
Yeah, that was well done. That HBO, they did a nice job with that. Okay, so let's get to some questions. Okay. All right, here we go. In the video, what two elements showed the motivation of George Washington to become president? What did the video depict? What's his motivation to agreeing to become president of the United States?
Well, I mean, he fought the British for them to kind of rule themselves, like.
Right. He fought for the United States, but that's not the same thing as becoming president now that the war is over. What's his motivation for doing it? There was a couple of elements in that scene that brought it out.
To defend the Constitution?
He said to defend the Constitution. That's what he said. But that's his job description. What's really his?
Well, he really believed in the Constitution so much that he wanted to make sure it was protected by being president.
Right, so he really wants to see the Constitution fully embraced and correct. What else? What other aspects or things that he did that support that? He acted in a certain manner, which was moving, certainly impactful to the people that knew him.
He was very humble. Like when he was repeating the oath, he was like an undertone, barely hear him.
Exactly. In other words, he was not promoting his brand of George Washington. Like otherwise, he would be shouting it to the. He would be using it as an opportunity to build his brand and show off. He spoke in a very very mild manner. What else? There's more elements. If you noticed.
He added, so help me God, to the end of the oath.
Yes, he did. So help me God. In other words, so he's viewing this as sort of like a religious duty. This is not about him being the most, famous person. What else did he do when he said that? What did he do right after he said, so help me God?
He bowed to the crowd.
Bowed and kissed the Bible first, and he bowed to the crowd. Yeah, so he's showing himself that he is not, this is not about him. As much as it could be not about him, he's trying to demonstrate that he's about service. He says when he walked into the room, when John Adams is sort of stalling till he shows up, he says, I'm at your service. And, that's the, he really meant it. And that's why he was the only president to be elected unanimously by all of the states. He swept the Electoral College. Okay. Happened once. Unlikely to happen again. So, all right. What is the difference in the relationship with the people of an elected president versus a tyrant? Basic point. All right, Shana.
An elected president is wanted by the people, whereas a tyrant just comes in and takes the power. And so he'll have a better relationship with the people as an elected president because he was chosen by them.
Yes. And how does he relate? How does the president relate to the people elected versus the tyrant relate to the people?
The tyrant just comes in and enforces and acts whatever he wants to do. Whereas the president will, who's elected by the people, will listen to the concerns of the people and do what's best for the people.
Yes. The tyrant is there to use the people. The tyrant is the people are part of his resource, part of his empire, part of his what he's going to use. Like, think Ahasuerus. When Ahasuerus needed a new wife, what did he do? He called all the good-looking women from all over his empire to come for the audition. So he's only concerned about himself. He's not concerned about the wealth being and of his empire. He's concerned about the empire as far as it maintains his control over the people. Okay. Now, three, this goes, now let's see if you guys are, you guys did well in American history. What was George Washington's, what was George Washington afraid of that any president would become? What was George Washington's fear?
He would become like a tyrant or like a king, like some.
Yes, that's it. He would get. In fact, one of his generals, so under his a colonel rather, under his thing, sent a famous letter. This is, goes back 7 years before he became president, saying, "We want you to become a king, King George, but it would be a constitutional monarchy. It wouldn't be without the will of the people, but he still wanted to become a king." And there's a famous letter, which we still have, his response to that, absolutely repudiating that possibility. And in fact, they want him to do, what else did they want? There's another quote. What, after he finished his first 4-year term, what did they want him to do? Yes, Klein pointed out, they wanted to do another term, but he didn't want to become, king. He wanted to, for America and its form of government to be successful, specifically, even though that he was very usually popular, and even if he would be make a great king, because he probably would have made a great king, but nevertheless, he didn't want that form of governance to run the United States. Okay. Now let's take it up a notch. What is the difference in their relationship to God of an elected president or a tyrant? A little more of a sophisticated question. How does the elected president relate to God, and how does the tyrant relate to the God, to rid of God?
I think it goes back to what Shane was saying before. The tyrant is, right? The tyrant, it's all about him. It's not about God. He's the God. He's in control. And the elected president, assuming he has a God, he's a trusted servant to his people, to the community.
Exactly. In other words, that's exactly correct. That so help me God, George Washington viewed himself as a vessel, as an agent for God to run justly the state of the United States of America. A tyrant either A, views himself as a god or semi-god like Paro, or you had throughout the Middle Ages what they called the divine right of kings, where they felt like God wants, you know, I've been selected by God to be the tyrant. you're on mute, so we don't hear you.
Sorry, what?
No, Chaim, if you were talking, you're on mute. Okay, never mind.
Oh, no, sorry. Go ahead, Ron.
All right.
I have my daughter here, and I was just saying what you were doing in the shir, setting it up before we get into the parsha stuff. And I love this.
Good. All right, so let's get in. With that introduction, we start off with the very beginning of the parsha. The beginning of the parsha deals with the special laws that relate to the Kohanim, to the priests, to the descendants of Aharon. All right, they have special rules and regulations, which are still in force today. Okay. All right, so let me have somebody read. Let me pick Suzanne.
Okay. God told Moses to declare the following to Aaron's descendants, the priests. Let no priest defile himself by contact with the dead among his people, except for such close blood relatives as his mother, father, son, daughter, or brother. He may also allow himself to become ritually unclean for his deceased virgin sister, who is also close to him, as long as she is not married. However, a husband may not defile himself for his dead wife if she is legally unfit for him. Let no priest shave off patches of hair from his head. Let them not shave the edges of their beards and not make gouges in their skin. They must be holy to their God and not profane their God's name. Since they present God's fire offerings, the food offering for their God, they must remain holy.
Okay, go on.
The high priest. These are the rules for the high priest among his brothers, upon whose head the anointing oil has been poured, and who has been inaugurated to wear the special priestly vestments. He shall not go without a haircut, and shall not allow his vestments to be torn. He shall not come in contact with any dead body. He shall thus not defile himself, even for his father or mother. In such a case, he may not even leave the sanctuary. He will then not profane his God's sanctuary, since his God's anointing oil is upon him. I am God.
Okay, good. Let me do a quick summary. So we have two categories of Kohanim. We have a regular Kohen, all right? And then we have the Kohen God of the high priest. He's in charge of all the Kohanim. And all right, so what is the difference in regard to going to a funeral? What funeral can the Kohen, regular Kohen, attend? Sean?
His close, like, relatives. So mother, right, father, son, daughter, brother.
Exactly. The seven relatives. And also his wife. He can't, but if he married a wife that he's not allowed to marry, he can't attend her funeral. Okay. And what they used to do is that they would also do these various, in the ancient world, they would, as signs of mourning, they would cut off patches of hair. They, you know, they made gouges in their skin. So there's a specific prohibition for them to do that because they are holy to their God. Okay, so we'll get into that. And they also, they present Hashem's, they work in the Beit HaMikdash. And what about the Kohen Gadol? What funeral can he attend, according to the Pasuk? All right, Shana?
Rabbi, can we just explain about the sister first?
The sister, yeah. So if she's not married and part of, if she's not married, the Pasuk is that if she's still single, he would attend her funeral if she passed away. But if she's married, he would not. Now, why is that? That's a good question. I'm not sure. I have to look it up. So why? Well, you know, because, you know, what's the difference? Okay, so so we'll have to explore that. All right, and what's the rule about the Kohen Gadol? What funeral can he attend according to the Pesukim?
None.
The Kohen Gadol has to be a haunted. So, of course, that brings up to the question is, question number five, why is a Kohen forbidden to attend a funeral except for his seven close relatives? And why is the Kohen Gadol, forbidden to attend any funerals, even his own parents? What's going on there? We have discussed this in earlier years. This part.
Wait, Rabbi. We might have an answer to Shana's Kasha here. Can we introduce Etty, my daughter here?
Yeah, Etty, how you doing?
Good. I have an answer. Basically, when like right now, my father, I'm a bas yisrael. So my father's yisrael. So if that's like until I get married, like if I marry a Levi or a Kohen, I'll become a Levi or a Kohen. But like before, if I'm not married, then I'll still be like part of my father's house.
Excellent. So she's, as he's saying that if she now marries a non-Kohen, then you'd be part of a different tribe, and essentially, you become a Levi or a Yisrael. So that's good. Now your theory will work if, let's say, that Kohen, that girl Kohen marries another Kohen. According to your theory, the Kohen
still
would be
a Kohen.
Right. But question is, would the we have to look this up? Would the brother be able to attend the funeral of his sister who married another Kohen? According to your theory, since he's still she's still a Kohen, it should work out. So I have to check that up. I'm not sure. This is some good question, and I like the way you're thinking. Thank you so much for sharing. Appreciate that. All right, little nachas there, Chaim. Very good.
Yeah, I didn't even know she was paying attention.
This call, no, I need to phone in an answer. That's it. All right. So the question is, so why can't the Cohen why can't he go to another funeral? I mean, he's there to serve the people. Everybody knows, anybody who has been to a funeral, certainly the rabbi plays a very important role. So the Cohen was a rabbi of the ancient world. So let him, why can't he be Matama? Why can't he not go to the funeral? I mean, the verse is suggests a reason, but what do you guys say?
I think it has to do with like extra levels of like holiness or kedusha. I mean, so like a Kohen Gadol is even more like strict, a higher level of holiness needed.
So, but is it? But isn't being involved in burying the dead and being involved in the dead, isn't that a mitzvah? So why would his holiness not let him do a mitzvah? So I'm not sure about holiness, holiness in general, because doing a mitzvah is a holy thing.
Well,
Adrian.
I think it's difficult to answer any of these questions without, I might be jumping the gun here, but what's the underlying policy? I mean, one theory I have is it is about Kedusha, it is about holiness. You know, getting in contact with a dead body, it does defile the priest. Because
so let's pause right there. What does that mean, defile the priest? Does he have the cooties now? What does that mean? Once the Kohen, touches or comes in contact with the dead, what is he prohibited in doing?
He's prohibited in bringing sacrifices.
Right. He can't work at all in the Beit HaMikdash. He's not able to work in the temple at all. So you know what I'm saying? So it's not about the dead body confirms something toxic or poisonous or voodoo-esque. Is that his job, a la George Washington, is he is now working for the people. And the Kohen's job is to be working in the temple, or available to work in the temple all the time. Now there's two levels. There's the regular Kohen that comes in at shifts. So he's allowed to, for seven relatives, and must become Tamei. But the Kohen Gadol, who's always serving every single day in every single service, Yom Kippur, the only person working in the temple at that time, in the Mikdash, he has to be exclusively available. In other words, he's 100% committed to the people by being their representative in the Beit HaMikdash. So by analogy, even though that the Kohen Gadol, now by the way, they would do aspects of Shiva. In other words, they wouldn't be unshaven. They would certainly, they work in the Mikdash. You could still do nichama avail to them. We're going to get to that. Still comfort them. So they're still in Shiva. They're just working during Shiva. Okay, but in the Mikdash. Okay, so that's.
So if these laws still apply, wouldn't it be difficult for a Kohen to be like a pulpit like rabbi? Because don't they have to go to
Sean, you are on the money here. So Rabbi Avi Weiss is a Kohen. He is the rabbi, the senior rabbi at the Riverdale Hebrew Institute. He always had an assistant rabbi. And their one quality of the assistant rabbi was had to be a non-Kohen so he could do all the funerals. Yeah, so being a shul rabbi, doing funerals is a major part of your portfolio. And if you are a Kohen, then you typically have an assistant rabbi where that guy will step in for that particular activity. But excellent point. Yes. Yes. That has been noticed before, Sean. Yes. So the analogy to George Washington is like, just as George Washington had pledged his uncommitted commitment to the Constitution, committed to the welfare and well-being of the state of the United States of America, the Kohen, there's two levels of Kohen. There's the regular Kohen, and who has a significant involvement of being in the temple, and then there's the Kohen Gadol, who is exclusive. He's exclusive to the Beit HaMikdash. Even he can't even attend his own parents' funeral, which is rough. Okay, it's a big commitment, big thing. All right, let's continue on now. But there's an exception. Every rule has an exception. The Kohen Gadol from the Psukim say that he cannot become Tameh. He cannot become ritually impure to be involved in the dead, except for one case. For 500 points and the square, can anybody tell me the one exception where the Kohen Gadol must become ritually impure and must be involved in the burial of the dead? Does anybody know that case? I may have mentioned it over the years. I don't remember. They might know. Chaim, I bet your daughter knows.
She knows and I know, but that's because we were educated by Yeshiva Day School.
Right. So there's the one case of the Kohen Gadol there's one case where the Kohen Gadol must be involved in the funeral. Suzanne.
So I was going to guess if there's like a body on the road or something and no one's around. Did I get it?
Yes. The case called Maiden. Yes. Suzanne, correct. 500 points in the square. Thank you, Suzanne. The category called Mate Mitzvah, literally the corpse of Mitzvah, which is we're going to now do the halacha. We're going to have Shana read. This is Laws of the Mourner, Chapter 3, Halacha 8. Suzanne, excellent job. Well done. Dad.
When a priest, even a high priest, encounters an unattended corpse on the road, Mate Mitzvah, literally corpse of Mitzvah, he is obligated to become impure for its sake and bury it. What is meant by an unattended corpse? A Jewish corpse cast away on the road without anyone to bury it. This is a halacha conveyed by the received tradition. When does the above apply? When the priest is alone and there is no one else with him. Even when he calls out on the road, no one answers him. If, however, when he calls, others answer, this is not considered an unattended corpse. Instead, he should call to the others and they should come and tend to the corpse.
Excellent. Okay, so as Suzanne mentioned before, and as a Rambam, if the Kohen, imagine we as those of us who were who went with me to Israel, we are hiking through the beautiful hills of the Shomron. And if, God forbid, we found if the person was a Kohen or Kohen Gadol and comes across a dead person, he can't just say, whoa, I'm a Kohen Gadol, got to stay away. I got work to do in the Beit HaMikdash. No. So you see, he has to call out. Now, is there somebody else who can do it? Then he's attending to it, then they do it. But if nobody else do it, he has to do it. Either bury the body right there or take the body to a proper place for burial, whatever attending means in that circumstance. Which, of course, brings up the obvious question. Why is the Kohen Gadol obligated to become Tameh, become ritually impure, and attend to the burial needs of this forgotten Jew? So why is this exception?
Well, you have conflicting responsibilities. One is to God, and then another one is to a fellow human being. In this case, no one else can take care of the other human being. And as we know from Abraham and the other stories, even when Abraham was having a conversation with God, and a visitor came, he was sort of, you know, he took care of the visitor, even as he was having prophecy with God. So our responsibilities to human beings usually trump our responsibilities with God.
Well, if that's the case, then why does the Kohen always become tame to let's say? So why, if he comes to it first, why does he call out then?
Yeah, I'm sorry. If he comes to it first, then
he's not allowed to attend to it until he knows for sure he's the only person available.
Well, that's precisely it. Until he knows for sure that he's the only person available. So if you can avoid the conflict, then you avoid it. But if the conflict is inevitable, then our relationship to other human beings trump.
Okay, so I would tweak
what Adrian's saying a little bit to the aspect of our obligation to God trumps it, and this is a God obligation. So
you could argue these are both a God obligation because they're both mitzvot.
But back to the George Washington, it's a mitzvot, but it's a specific mitzvot category that God put for Kohen Gadol in this situation. It's like a trusted servant. He's not doing his will. He might want to stay pure and holy. At the end of the day, the God's will in this scenario is to mace mitzvah, which is the respect of, right? It is the respect of mankind in the aspect of man was created in God's image, and we have a covenant of bria slash, right? That's a trump mitzvah according to God's law. Okay. So I guess it's just a tweak. It's just, well, you want to call it God or human, but human because of God, that could be just a perspective or a nuance in semantics.
Okay, so I want to give some more information for us we're going to put Adrian's thesis on the table here, and we will bring out more information. We'll see how this goes. Okay, so now we're going to go to the, so let's, in order to understand that, we have to actually go into what is the obligation to bury any Jew, okay? Let's go. What's the mitzvah? All right, Sean, read it out.
It's a positive mitzvah to bury the persons executed by the court on the day of their execution, as Rambam, Laws of Sanhedrin 15:8 states. But you shall not leave his body on the pole overnight. Rather, you shall bury him on that same day. For hanging human corpse, a blasphemy of God, and you shall not defile your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Not only those executed by the court, but anyone who leaves a deceased overnight without burying him transgress a negative commandment. If, however, a burial is delayed overnight to honor the deceased, for example, to bring a coffin or shrouds, there's no transgression.
Okay, so it's interesting. We learn the obligation, the positive mitzvah to bury somebody, because the Torah prohibits how do we deal with the criminal. Okay, the case is learned from the criminal. The mitzvah is you cannot leave a person who was hung, okay, hanging overnight, and says it's a blasphemy of God, which we have to answer. Why is it the blasphemy of God? We have to explain that. Okay. Rather, as soon as he is executed, what do you got to do?
Bury him.
And you cannot. And what's the prohibition?
To leave him hanging.
For how long?
Overnight.
Overnight. In other words, let's say he was executed at 3 p.m. You got to make sure that he is buried by sundown.
Was this a violation in Jesus' execution and his crucifixion?
Well, the Romans weren't too careful about Jewish law, were they? If you're concerned about halacha, then they shouldn't have executed. They shouldn't have, killed him at all. So whatever, that they weren't asking too many questions. In fact, they purposely wanted to. They crucified what they viewed as criminals or people, enemies of the state, in order that people should see. So they would keep those bodies hanging on for a long period of time, so people would be scared of, rightfully scared, terrified by the Roman regime, and basically would listen to whatever the Roman rulers said. Here, there's a mitzvah that the court, even if you have a Jewish criminal, he was hung for whatever crime he did, okay? That body must be buried properly, even him, So so from that, so certainly if by the criminal, we have an obligation to be, we're not allowed to do what? To leave the body overnight, get to it when we get to it. You have certainly a regular good Jew, you certainly must bury in that the very same day. Now, classically in America, let's say a person passes away Monday morning, okay? Frequently, they're not going to bury that person on Monday. Why not in America? Just give me the reason.
It could be a variety of things. One being that you're waiting for out-of-town family to come in or just to make the arrangements if they haven't already been made.
Right. So first of all, all of them figure in. They're all viewed as kavod hamet. In other words, you are honoring the deceased by having all the close relatives show up. So they'll give them a travel day to fly in. You know what I'm saying? Or to have them properly, have all the processes where they do a tahara, they wash the body, they prepare the body for burial, and then they put into a proper coffin, etc. So that's a kavod hamet demands that you're allowed. That's allowed, but you just can't just leave the body, to deal with that. So we see here that the Kohen Gadol, Misora has said that if you would leave the body overnight, the verse, the pasuk from Devarim here has a very strange phrase. What would it be? What's the problem? So you leave the body. That's not the person. That's just the vessel he came in. What's the problem? What do they call it? What's the problem here?
The verse says it is a blasphemy of God.
Right. You're degrading God. But how am I degrading God? That's not God. You have to make a step here. How is leaving the body hanging or not unburied a blasphemy of God? That we have to get into that.
I think it might be one of two options. Either the body has a semblance of God, or the
person... Well, hold on. God's not physical, so that we know that can't be an option.
Or the person who was derelict, or callous, if you may, is acting in a way that's blasphemous and that it doesn't comport with God's attitude.
Oh, you mean or if they would just leave the body hanging?
Right.
Okay. Good. So for hanging a human corpse is a blasphemy to God. Now, either it could be referring to the person who's leaving it hanging, or that thing itself, that object itself, is somehow itself a sort of like a disgrace to God. Now, Chaim mentioned something a little earlier, which is one possible answer, which is that we say the phrase that, it's in Pirkei Avot. We're learning Pirkei Avot. It's a custom among Jews to read Pirkei Avot in the afternoon of Shabbat. Chaviv Adam, man is cherished, shenivra b'tzalmo. He is fashioned to reflect a godliness. So, even though that the nefesh, the soul of man, is no longer associated with his dead body, it's essentially, it's now decomposing flesh. Nevertheless, we look at it, we associated that person with a godliness. He has a mind, he's a thinking, free-willed being. And therefore, to degrade the body is essentially to degrade the idea of Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, we therapeutically must be engaged in proper burial. Okay? So that, now taking that all together, now I think we have enough, is that apparently the Misora, on one hand you have two, as going back to what Adrian pointed out, we have a conflict. We have A, the Kohen Gadol's mandate, so the George Washington mandate to be constantly serving in the Beit Mikdash. He becomes Tamei. He's now out of commission for at least 7 or 8 days, A, due to the process to become ritually pure again, versus the degradation of the Tzelem Elokim, the degradation of the, and the lack of Kavod HaMeit. And there's another principle here. we're not showing honor to this person because you're treating him like a piece of garbage. You're letting him sit there out in the sun. So
is that basic covet of brios?
Well, they call covet a mate. Covet a mate means having reverence for the deceased body, not the reverence for the deceased person, which is expressed by taking care of the body that he used to inhabit. You know what I'm saying? So we show. So there's two things going on here. We are there's a lo tase, a prohibition. I can't keep the body hanging. I must bury it as soon as possible. Why? Because it's a denial of how man reflects God in a significant way. Okay, it's the denial of Tzelem Elokim, the principle of how the godliness that is now being degraded. Because you're saying that that's not really anything special. It's just a piece of flesh, okay? And there's a positive that I have to show honor to a deceased person by giving him a proper burial. So those two principles, even though it's not overt in the text, that's why it's a tradition, is Midirei HaKabbalah, not mysticism, but from the tradition of the Mesorah. Therefore, that even the Kohen Gadol, if there's nobody else, he's the last guy standing, he has to become Tameh to take care of the person. Now, let me ask you one simple question. What kind of person would have been died out in the road or out in the field? What kind of person typically is found dead in our own society, sadly?
Homeless?
A homeless person, a derelict, a person who has been forgotten by society. There's another message here. Here's who is the spiritual leader of the people, the Kohen Gadol, and nevertheless, he has to become Tamei for the person whose social status is presumed to be the lowest. Because every Jew, every person, reflects the godliness and therefore has to be taken care of. So it's a very, even the most rarefy, or using the term that people use, the most holy Jew, the Kohen Gadol, who's involved in exclusively in the national service, has to put that on pause if he's the last guy to take care of the Jew who's forgotten, the forgotten Jew. So that's a very important. So if that's true by the Kohen Gadol, that the significance of every, therefore you see from that, we have to, think about every Jew. Every Jew has infinite worth. So just to think about how we concern about people. Let's take another fascinating halacha that reflects the same idea. Let me have Adrian read this small halacha here. 13:4. This law is a mourner. Mourning.
When a deceased person has no mourners, he must be comforted.
No, who must be comforted?
In other words,
the guy dies and he leaves no mourners.
Right.
So basically, this happens, by the way. In fact, I'm dealing with a situation that might end up, one of our former senior fellows has a distant relative who's like 98 years old, and she has outlived everybody. Okay. Unfortunately, she's in the hospital now, and there's nobody there who has a obligation to mourn for them, to sit shiva for them. There's no children, there's no siblings, there's nobody. It happens. But what's the halacha? So therefore, they die. Is there no shiva? Let's go on. Let's see what happens.
10 upright men from the community at large come and sit in his place throughout the 7 days of mourning. Others gather around them. If there are no 10 fixed people who remain throughout the 7 days, each day 10 other people are selected and they sit in his place.
Okay, although and they receive officially the nechama. I left that part out.
Is the 10 men because you need a minion?
They're not doing a minion there. They're so.
But it's 10, though.
It is 10. It's 10, and it's significant, and it is a minion. But the question is, you know, in a regular mourning case, you don't need a minion. Let's say you have, let's say a person dies and leaves three, four kids. Okay, they're sitting Shiva. Okay, that's a good Shiva house, even if one person's sitting Shiva. Here, if the person has no Shiva thing, they have 10 people. Let me just get that last bit of luck. I'm sorry, what happened there? Okay. Grab that halacha real quick. Bear with me. Okay, we're going to go to the Hilchos Avel 13. By the way, this is the Rambam on Chabad.org, very handy. And they, of course, given the, what was that? Here we go. What halacha was that? What did I say before? What number is that?
4.
Okay, let me go back to 4. Okay. Oh, that's it. Okay, so he's okay, so that's the entire halacha. But there's there. Let's see what he says. One second. I think there's this. Okay, let me just see. I'm gonna check out the Hebrew. I think they're missing a little phrase here. Hold on. I'm checking the Hebrew here. I'm checking the critical version here. Something's a little bit amiss here. 13. Right. They sit there. Okay, no, that's actually, it's accurate. Okay. So what are they doing? So I ask you a simple question. What are they doing? What are they accomplishing? There's no mourners. There's nobody to receive the comfort.
I would say it's probably the same principles that we've been discussing before. Vis-a-vis the relationship to a deceased who, even though he passed away, he was still a person who was embedded with a divine spark from God, and also about the community and how they behave and how they try to emulate God by being kind and merciful, even to those who don't have anyone around them.
Exactly. The best analogy that we have in our American society is in the Washington, D.C., you have the tomb of the unknown soldier. And if you go there, you'll always see, no matter what the weather is, there is an honor guard of two members of, I think it's the Marines, who, no matter what the weather is, they're guarding that. And and what idea are they showing by having a ceremonial guard by the tomb of the unknown soldier, no matter what the weather is? What idea are they communicating?
That you're never alone.
Okay. What does it mean to be what does it mean by an unknown soldier? What is an unknown soldier?
I believe it goes back to World War I, when they didn't have a way of identifying bodies or ruins of soldiers who were killed. And so they're unknown because they weren't identified.
Right. So you know you have the body, but they there's no ways for identifying. Either they got injured so brutally. So what are they demonstrating? They're demonstrating by having, it says, like, even though this person gave the ultimate sacrifice for the United States of America, his memory and identity and service is always valuable. He has worth. And by having an honor guard, they're showing that this guy, he didn't, he He didn't die for no reason. We honor him and the person who unfortunately did not even get the benefit of a full burial for all the relatives. So here too, when we have the Jew, the elderly Jew who passes away, and there's nobody there to sit shiva for them, we do not allow that person to go into the night and disappear. So you see now there's two ideas of a shiva visit. One is a kavod achayim. You're showing honor to the living, to the mourners, right? By being there therapeutically, visiting them, being supportive. We'll talk about that in more specifics. That's one part. But even if there are no mourners, there's a kavod amet. Not only do you give the Jew a burial, but you give him a shiva, like an honor guard shiva. So he shouldn't. That person should not be viewed as insignificant. Every Jew has to be viewed as a being who has infinite value. And if he doesn't have a family to sit shiva for him, we sit shiva for him. And that goes, now we go into Scott's question. Why 10 men? Why just have one guy? Why 10? What is the significance of 10? 10 men. And not any kind of men, but upstanding men. In other words, high, you know, people who are like leaders.
Might it be connected to, well, the 10 might be connected to the same reason you need 10 for a minion, that I think the Shekhinah rests with 10 men or something like that. And I would say for the leaders, it goes back to the same idea of the Kohen Gadol and the Meit HaMitzvah, that it's people who, even though this person might be unknown or the person doesn't have anyone, that we're all somehow connected to him, no matter what our status is in the community.
Exactly. 10, which the Shekhinah is Shora, is the smallest representation of the Jewish people. A minion is sort of like the Congress of the Jewish people. Or as a Congress is 435, or including the Senate, 535 members represents the will of the people. When you have 10 Jewish men, it represents a microcosm of the Jewish people. Okay? So the Jewish community, as it were, is coming and showing kavod, reverence and respect to the person who's passed on. And the fact that they're distinguished people is even greater honor, because it's not just a regular honor guard, it's a distinguished honor guard. That's why if you see the after class, you go on to YouTube and you see the honor guard by the tomb of things. They wear very special uniform. They look very sharp. They give a tremendous kavod, and that's
been rifle going. Is also especially is really special. It's all like chrome.
Yes. It is. It's been chromized, whatever they call that. Yeah,
really polished. Yeah,
polished. So yes, they look. It's a very distinguished thing. And tremendous kavod, and people actually, part of when they visit Washington, they go to people watch that, because it's a sight to behold. Okay, now I want to move the class a little bit more pragmatically. Okay, so we have two categories here. We have kavod ha-chayim, showing honor to the living, such as be the mourners, right? And kavod meitim, and having regard, reverence, respect, honor to those who have passed on. So I'm going to go through five specific scenarios, which I'm now going to teach you about. What is aninut, or in Ashkenazic, aninus? Aninut, aninus. What do I know what that is?
Morning.
An avel, avelut is mourning. An avel is a mourner. What is an onay or aninut? The specific stage.
From the time of the death, when you find out.
Yes. Aninut, there's no
until
no burial. Correct. Suzanne is correct. An onane, or for a woman, an onenet, or the noun aninut, is the state where the person has just lost the relative until burial. Okay? So at that point, there's a prohibition of eating meat and wine. Okay? And they're exempt from all positive mitzvot. They don't daven. They don't put on tefillin. They don't say any brachot. Okay? If aninut lasts a couple of days, that's it. Kind of weird state to be in. Okay? You don't bench. You don't, you know, all the blessings, all the davening. Don't put on talis, no tefillin, nothing. And you're in a state of meto muto lefanov. It's as if the dead is before you. And you are focused on what activity? All the preparations necessary to be involved to get the funeral done properly. That is speaking to the funeral director and the Chevra Kedisha, and that's calling up the relatives who have to come in. That is writing a thoughtful eulogy, okay? And during that time, you're exempt from all mitzvot, positive mitzvot, and you can't, and you're prohibited in eating meat or wine, okay? So is that a kavod achayim? Is that showing honor to the living relatives? Or is that showing kavod hamet, or showing reverence to the deceased?
Kavod hamet.
Yes. You're exempt. One reason that the Gemara gives why exempt, because you're osig b'mitzvah, patur b'mitzvah. You're involved in the mitzvah. You're exempt from everything else. In other words, ensuring that the funeral is done in a proper and proper and full fashion is your entire focus. And therefore, you're exempted from mitzvahs. Another angle, which Rabbi Soloveitchik advanced, which is that you're obviously overwhelmingly distraught. Your relative is just passed away, and you're not deemed as a person who can really be involved in positive mitzvot. So there's another angle. But right now, your whole schedule is focused on ensuring that the most honorable funeral and best hesped, which is a eulogy, is taken care of. Okay? It's something that we're all going to experience. Okay? That's the way of the world. So by doing so and doing that in an effective manner, that is showing tremendous reverence to the person. The person is the person's memory and legacy. We discussed this in the past. Is that a very key point here? And it can be done in a okay way, and it can be done in a most excellent way. And that's why the onane stage is a very critical time. What is the word hesped mean? Hebrew word, hesped.
Eulogy.
Eulogy. Okay. One hesped, two hespedim. Okay. So that you'll hear those words. A eulogy. What is the purpose of the eulogy? Is that a kavod achayim or a kavod hamet? Or possibly both? What do you say?
Kavod hamet.
All right, so the Gemara debates that issue. So if it's kavod achayim, if it's really to show, to lift the family up, then they could say, we don't want to do it. If it's kavod hamet, then they can't, it's not their honor to pardon and to forgive. So the halacha is that it's essentially kavod hamet. And therefore, if the person who passed away says, I do not want a eulogy, you can say that. No eulogies. But if they don't say that, the family can't say, we don't really want you. I'm not a good speaker. I don't feel comfortable. No, cover the mace. Either you have to do it or you got to get somebody to do it. They used to have hired professional masbidim. You know what I mean? You give them all information, they put together the hesped in the time. So you got to do that. All right, kvura. What is the Hebrew word kvura? What is that? Well, that's another mitzvah. What's that mean? Hebrew word here, kfura. These are words you're going to know. I mean, this is like I'm giving you some Judaism 101 over here, guys. Kfura, you got to know this stuff. That's it. Kfura means burial. The mitzvah of kfura. The Hebrew word is likbor. The noun kever is a burial site or a cemetery. Or the cemetery called Beit HaKvarot, the place where they have, the burial spots. Okay? Kever. What mitzvah is that? There's a mitzvah of kfura. That touches in another mitzvah. Is that a kavod ha'chaim or kavod ha'mesim?
Kavod ha'metim.
Kavod ha'mesim, because you're giving the body, you are showing reference to the memory of the person by disposing their body in an honorable way. Okay? Okay. Now we have the mourners who are now, once the body is buried, there is, for every person, there is a Shiva 7-day period, which has the most intense mourning. Then it goes to the remaining part of the month till 30 days is a less intense mourning. And then for mom and dad, for parents, the mourning will actually extend in a limited way for 12 months. Is that Kavod HaChaim? Kavod HaMeis. Is that showing honor to the living or honor to the dead?
Kavod HaMeis.
So one second. So for the mourners themselves, them doing the activity of taking a break from regular life to think about and discuss the impact of the person is a kavod ha'meit. But then we get to the nicham avelim, comforting the mourners. Is that a kavod ha'chaim or kavod ha'meitim or both? And why?
I would say both, but a little more heavily towards Kavod Chaim.
Okay, so we saw from the guy who has no mourners that they set up a shiva house, so it's certainly a Kavod HaMeit, but it's also a Kavod HaChaim. When you go and sit there at the shiva, you are showing that person personal, you're showing that you care. You are being there therapeutically for the person. You are supporting them through a terrible time. And people showing up, we've discussed this in other classes, makes a huge difference. Certainly if it's done properly. And even though that you can't bring the person back, but it's a comfort, and we'll get into exactly is what is the comfort is. We say at the end, the Ashkenazic tradition is to say the following phrase, Hamakom Yenachem Eschem Besoch Shar Avelet Yom Shlayim. May the Omnipresent One comfort you among the other mourners of Zion and Israel. Okay? And Jerusalem. Sorry, not Israel. Jerusalem. How is that a comfort? May you be covered among all the other mourners, the Jewish people. How is that a comfort? May Hashem comfort you among the other mourners of Israel. What really is being expressed there? What really is the comfort of that?
That the person's not alone, that we are all one body, one politic body at least. And yeah, it's sort of sharing the pain, which provides certain relief.
100% correct. You're sharing to the person that your family is not limited to your biological family. We, the Jewish community, the Jewish people, are there for you and are with you. And you are a brother and you are a sister. And that's why you don't have to say really anything. If the person's not in the mood to talk, they don't have to talk, and you don't have to talk because your presence is a support. Because you're communicating nonverbally that you care, and you're there to sort of hold their grief, hold their pain, at least a little bit. And that is very, very critical. Now, we get to a little more controversial phrase, which I'm going to get into, stir the chunk a little bit here. Is it proper to say only simchas, only happy occasions? As you walk out of, you say, people will say, you know, only simchas. What do you think about that? Is that a proper thing to say? Why or why not?
Well, it's good in the sense that when a person is depressed, they sort of only see darkness. So to bring forth the possibility of happiness in the future is therapeutic.
So I agree with you. So I say, the way that I say is, may we meet next at a simcha. I find that saying only simchas is actually philosophically problematic. What are you really saying? Really, if it was up to us, there would not be this loss. You know what I mean? You're basically, part of the thing that the code, when a person loses somebody, they have to make a blessing. Blessed are you, God, King of the Universe, Shadayan MS, that the true judge, which means that we have to accept the fact that our relative has passed on is an act of justice. Can I explain the justice? No. But I have to accept it. I got to accept it. So if I'm saying only simchas, I'm really saying that no, this is a mistake here. Really? Nobody should die, and we should only have parties. Okay? All right?
That's well, if you really want to get technical, everybody knows when planning a simcha, the stress. Okay. Or getting ready for a simcha, the stress.
Right. So first of all,
we get so technical, right, instead of saying we should meet at simchas, and we say only simchas, it's always stress and simchas too.
Right. So, but that's not what they mean. They're not saying, may you be the harried and hassle host of a annoying bar mitzvah. They're not
correct. But people are saying, like Adrian's saying, right? Even though maybe
they mean well.
There's some people that are negative, and then they actually don't believe that God should kill somebody and take a life, right? And that it's God's world. But at the same time, just like we say Kaddish, that technical point that we're bringing on here.
That's why I like to thread the needle, which is give the positive point of like, we should meet next at a simcha, but without the denial, like only simchas, which has the connotation of like saying, you know, this shouldn't really be. The Ramah, the Ashkenazi commentator in the Shulchan Aruch, when he talks about mourning and, you know, visiting and doing Nicham Avel, you should not say, well, you know, so-and-so passed away, but what can we do? You know what I'm saying? It's a real shame, but what can we do? That's wrong, because you're saying that if I could undo it, I would. The bottom line is that part of the difficult thing about the reality is we have to accept the din. We talk about Hashem in two ways. Midat HaDin, the strict measure of law, and Midat HaRachamim, the compassionate side. Now, we like to talk about and focus upon Hashem is compassionate, and he is compassionate. But there is an idea of mishpat. When a person dies, that's mishpat. I mean, that's justice. Now, Judaism goes out. This is a whole conversation. I don't know, not for tonight, but that's when we say somebody passes on, we're saying that's not a violation of justice. Now, can we explain that? No, we cannot. It's not within our rubric. And that we touched upon Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous article on that, which is Koldo Dido Fake, where he deals with it specifically. The most extreme example of that, of course, is the tremendous loss during the Holocaust. Okay, a lot of juicy stuff. All right, guys, so but putting this all together, I'm going to summarize everything in 30 seconds. We started off with exploring George Washington, the unique person who was just really an outstanding person, who really dedicated heart and soul and his whole life to launched the United States of America, and we are the beneficiary of that. And he did it in as selfless a person could do. He was there to serve, he served, he cared, and he was selfless in that regard. I'm not saying he's a tzaddik. You know, I'm not saying he's a prophet, but he was within people go. He was, outstanding. Then we showed into we went to the Kohen and to the Kohen Gadol, who, due to their national responsibilities of working in the temple, that they have to limit, or in the case of Kohen Gadol, exclude their becoming not available by becoming Tamei. Then we brought up the exceptional case that Suzanne brought up for 500 points in square, which is the case of the Mate Mitzvah, which we explored that. Then we got into the idea of what is the obligation to bury, which is A, the removal of a negative. You're not allowed to blaspheme God by letting the corpse rot, which reflects the divinity, the unique godliness of a person, and the positive obligation of covenant and showing reverence to that body, which was the vessel of that person, by burying them as quickly as possible. And then we went into the idea of that to show the honor, we explore the idea of that even if somebody has no mourners, we set up an honorable shiva home, A. And then B, we explored the idea of the various ideas in mourning and how we show reverence, either we give support to the living and while simultaneously showing respect to the person who passed and reflecting upon the impact they made on this world. And it's also the mitzvah of Ve'ahavta Rechem Locha, love your fellow Jew as yourself, by being there for the person, attending the funeral, visiting the person during the Shiva, helping them out in any kind of way, and really being a source of emotional support through a challenging time. That was what we talked about today. So, hopefully this experience will not come soon to anybody. But hopefully you got a more measure to prepare to be able to deal with the scenario in a more thoughtful and grounded and mature way. All right, guys, I want to wish everybody a wonderful evening. And see you guys all. Some of you I'll see tomorrow and some I'll see you next week. All the best, all right, guys.
Bye. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.